This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. And for our last segment of this Halloween House of Horrors, live from the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh, we're talking about these charming creatures. Oh, yeah, bats. But despite their reputation, these creatures are actually indispensable. You may not want one in your house, but without bats, certain essential flowers would never be pollinated, and insect populations might not be kept in check. Lisa Gatens is the mammal curator at the museum. She's going to give a Science Cafe talk about bats tonight at 7 o'clock in the museum's Daily Planet Cafe. But first, she joins us in our studio. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Frank. Excited to be here.
It's good to have you here. So tell us now, it's Halloween, so we start right off with a vampire bat.
Right.
There is such a thing.
There are vampire bats.
Tell us about them.
There are three species of vampire bats. They occur only from Mexico through Central America and Northern South America. They are in a family of bats called the Phyllostomidae, which means leaf-nosed bats. Now, other members of this family of leaf-nosed bats are pollen and nectar feeders. The vampires, the three species of vampire bats, are the only bats and actually the only vertebrates that feed solely on blood.
How do they get it?
It's a tough way to make a living, but they're really good at it. One of the three species of vampire bats, the common vampire bat, feeds pretty much exclusively on mammals. And these days, that means domestic livestock primarily. The other two species feed primarily on birds, either birds that are perching in a roost in a tree or even a hen on the ground. They, instead of using the leafy projections on their noses that the family gets its name from to direct echolocation calls, in vampire bats, they have heat receptors in those leafy projections on their nose, and they use the heat receptors in those projections on their nose to detect beds of blood vessels that lie near the skin. So they approach a possible prey item, animal, and first of all, they listen to breathing to see if the animal's sleeping, and they can tell if it's asleep and approachable by the rhythm of its breathing. So then, once they've determined that the animal's asleep, they move in closer, and then with the heat receptors detect the presence of blood.
Well, this is amazing because I would guess that every animal has its own rhythm. So you've got to know a chicken from a cow and a bird, right? A smaller bird.
Right. And they do have a tendency to, again, so the one feeds on mammals and the other two feed primarily on birds, and they're able to detect the differences. Yes.
So do they use echolocation at all?
They use echolocation, but they, as opposed to insect feeding bats, which is what occurs in North Carolina, they echolocate at a much lower frequency. Don't necessarily use it to find their prey items. They use smell and, of course, vision.
So it's mostly just to get around, just mm-hmm. not to hit a tree and that sort of thing. So now here's the big question. So they've found the prey. It's asleep. It's ready for dinner. Two fangs suck out the blood?
No. They don't puncture and suck. They slice and lick. But the way they do this without waking up their prey item is really, really cool. And the whole process of blood feeding or sanguivory it's a hard way to make a living. And so they, of course, have to be very good at it in order to get 100% of their nutrients from blood. So they've located the blood vessel in a sleeping animal. They approach. They lick the skin to anesthetize it, because in the saliva of vampire bats is an anesthetic. So then they slice with these incredibly sharp incisors, which are the frontmost teeth, and the blood flows freely and they lap it up. And it flows freely because of the presence of an anticoagulant or a compound that's present in the saliva that prevents the formation of blood clots. And so this is their one shot at feeding for the night. So they sit there on the leg of a donkey or under a chicken or wherever they may be and lap this free-flowing blood. And they consume about half their body weight in blood at a feeding. Now, this is a lot of weight to put on and then return to the roost. So before they can do this comfortably or well at all, and this is a very vulnerable time for the bats, they must urinate. And so they've developed these very efficient you know, systems of filtration so that they can process the blood very quickly and dump most of it before they take off.
Wow. So and so for the older guys, I guess, then they with prostate problems, then they don't make it. They just don't fly anymore. So now we got this bird, this bat, and it's the only vertebrate. I'm curious about how this evolved. I mean, I guess that's always a mystery, but this is a peculiar way of making a living.
It is. It really is. How it evolved is not precisely known. So there are some pretty good guesses and one that's pretty commonly accepted. And that is based on a couple lines of evidence. But this one of the more widely accepted hypotheses as to the origin of blood feeding or sanguivory is that there was an ancestral proto-vampire that was carnivorous. And it would feed on small vertebrates that lived in trees, so other small bats, lizards, birds, and things of that nature at night. And they would sort of stealthily move along a branch, find a sleeping animal, and then attack and subdue it with bites, much like we see predation in lots of animals today. And so around this time, so we have a fossil record evidence of such a bat, okay? And around this time, we know that this was when when we first see vampire bats on the scene. And also, the other sort of key part of this puzzle is that at that time, larger vertebrates were moving into trees. So large birds, marsupials, possums and things like that, and sloths. Well, so this approach for sneaking up on a sleeping animal and biting it to subdue it wouldn't work if your would-be prey is much larger than you. All you would do is attract attention to yourself, then you could become prey to some other predator. So the things that we see current vampire bats using, you know, it's easy to see the selective pressures for developing an anesthetic so you don't wake your sleeping prey, and then this anticoagulant so the blood flows freely and they can feed efficiently.
What's the impact on the prey? Do they survive this?
Yes, typically. if they're visited once, even though they can lose a pretty good amount of blood.
But you said half their weight. So how big is the vampire?
Oh, that's a good question. Vampires weigh only a couple ounces. And so half of their – they're going to consume at a feeding a tablespoon or so of blood. Okay, so it's not going to drain an individual, especially something the size of a donkey. Repeated feedings might, especially something the size of a chicken.
Now, are they sort of territorial? Like, this is my donkey, back off, and so it's one bat per host?
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to it.
We'll have to go out and track them.
No, that's a really good question, but they're territorial in that they are spread throughout the landscape, and so might return to the same location night after night, whereas individuals that live, you know, several kilometers away wouldn't necessarily know to come to this particular donkey.
All right. And what about the name? Did they have a name before we knew much about vampires, or what happened there?
The name for vampire bats came from the vampire mythology, and early explorers, natural history explorers, to South America knew of blood-feeding bats. And so lots of things were labeled vampires erroneously. So there were some really large carnivorous bats in South America that might have the name vampire associated with them because early researchers, discoverers saw these bats and thought, oh, these must be the vampires. These must be the ones we've heard about. But they weren't. They're actually kind of small, unassuming little bats.
Real vampire bats. So as you talk about bigger bats, how big do bats get?
Even some of the bats in this family can be quite large. Some of the large fruit-eating bats in the New World are the size of my hand. The largest bats are fruit-eating bats, and they're all occur in the Old World tropics. And those are the monsters in size, not in terms of behavior. And they have about a 6-foot wingspan, the largest of them.
How tall do they stand?
Oh, they're not very the length of my forearm, maybe.
Well, that's a big bat with if I saw that bat, I would be afraid of it. But you're telling me I shouldn't.
They're diurnal. They're not nocturnal. The old world fruit bats aren't.
So unless I was a mango, I would have nothing
right.
to fear.
Okay. There, but they provide a valuable service. All of the fruit-eating bats in both the old and new world tropics, there's so much evidence that they play such a vital role in reforestation. They transport seeds away from the parent tree. And so that's just really important in helping, you know, keep gene flow between.
Yeah. Well, and there are some plants, aren't? Is it true that are almost uniquely and dependent on bats?
Yes, absolutely. And again, from this family that vampires are in, the leafed-nosed bats. There are a couple species in the leafed-nosed bats that exclusively feed on the nectar in agaves. And also some other night blooming cactus, the saguaros, for instance, and other night bloomers really attract these bats. So they feed on the nutrient rich nectar. And as they do so, like anything that is a nectar feeding animal, they pick up an awful lot of pollen and then transfer it.
So how widespread are bats? How many? I mean, it is a widespread, ubiquitous, and plentiful species at the moment.
All bats worldwide, there are a little over 1,100 species of bats. It's the most specious group, meaning there are more of that kind of species of bats than any other mammals except rodents. Bats occur everywhere in the world except at the poles, and only Antarctica is the only place, the only landmass without bats. They are extremely diverse, and so we've talked about, of course, blood-feeding bats and pollen-feeding bats and fruit-eating bats. And there are bats that show lots of diversity in food habits. And, of course, all of our North Carolina bats are insectivorous bats. They eat insects only. That's the only thing they eat. And, of course, provide an extremely valuable service in doing so.
Talk about those services. Well, just eating the insects, right? Mm-hmm. So they keep the insect population down. How many different species are there in North Carolina?
16.
16. Is that a lot for a place this size, or pretty common?
Like so many things, there's more diversity toward the tropics, and the higher you go in latitude, the fewer species you see, and you see this in just about everything. So the greatest diversity of bats is in this country is in the Southwest. Texas has about 45. And as we move further north, we see fewer and fewer. And when you get up to New England, there are only, you know, like 6 or 7.
And bats are not rodents?
No, they're not. They're not at all. They're not closely related to rodents at
not
all.
Not even closely related. No. They bear a resemblance, wouldn't you say? A little?
When you see a bat, and if I will have some images hopefully to show tonight at the cafe, they really kind of look like dogs.
Oh, okay. Flying dogs.
Yeah.
They look a little. I guess maybe it's the size. That's what makes you think
right.
a little bit
so
about
they
it.
Are mouse size. All of the bats in North Carolina are quite small, and people are kind of surprised when they see bats at how small they are, but they expect them to be much larger.
And bats really are not blind.
They are not. They have a lot of them especially have very acute vision.
They fly at and are most of them nocturnal?
Yes.
So they do. And echolocation is something they use mostly to find prey when they have echolocation
They use echolocation for lots of things, including communication between one another so they can tell secrets and we can't hear them. And they're really, really good at it. They're not the only mammals that use echolocation. Rodents, a lot of rodents use echolocation. And of course, everyone knows that cetaceans do, dolphins and whales. And they use them in different ways, of course. But bats are very, very good at echolocation. They can detect a prey item. Know that something that they're picking up is prey, if it's stationary or moving, if it's moving, what direction it's moving. Yeah. So they can detect something the size of a human hair.
How long has science known about echolocation in bats?
Ooh, that's a really good question.
The reason I ask it is because, you know, there's this phrase, right, blind as a bat. So then you would – I assume that was just related to the fact that you knew they used echolocation. I mean, why would anybody say that about a bat if it was getting along so well if it didn't know about echolocation?
That's a good question. And that phrase, I think, comes from it's directly related to them using echolocation and the way they fly around, because it looks like it's haphazard. But it is because they're echolocating, and they might be after something. So they kind of zoom around and zigzag a lot. We've known about echolocation for about 100 years, and there were some pretty nasty studies that were done to determine that, like blinding bats to determine that they could still get around quite well, actually. But when their ears were blocked, when hearing was diminished or taken away, then they cease to be able to function as well.
Okay, so the greatest threat to bats then is research scientists. But after that, I'm joking. What is now the threat to bats? Because they are under assault.
Yeah, absolutely. What's happening with bats right now? we continue to see, you know, threats from habitat loss and degradation, you know. So we take efforts to try to protect critical habitat. But so two big things are happening to bats right now. Wind farms, but the worst thing ever to happen to a wildlife species in this country is white nose syndrome. And I'll go back to wind farms real quickly because a lot of people may know that birds are killed at wind farms, and migratory birds are protected. And so there's mitigation that can protect birds from bird strikes at wind farms. Even people who know that may not be aware that so many more bats are killed at wind farms, and it's migratory bats. There's some research trying to understand how and why this happens, because it's a large thing on the landscape. And bats do not have to come in contact with a spinning blade in order to die. It's barotrauma. So there's a pressure differential near the spinning turbines that actually, that kills at least some of the bats. And then the second thing that I, you know, need to mention is white nose syndrome. And I know that there was a recent program white nose syndrome. And so it killed an estimated 5 to 7 million bats in eastern North America, in U.S. and Canada, 22 states, and I think 4 Canadian provinces. And we don't see the light yet.
No, it's cure for that.
Yeah, it's a bad news story.
Lisa, a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lisa Gaten's mammal curator at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. She's going to be here tonight for Science Cafe Thursday night. The doors open here at the Nature Research Center, and you will hear more about bats from Lisa tonight here at the Nature Research Center, or find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. And that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. It's produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Bryson Russell, the intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.
Ha 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 ha!